Ladies and gentlemen, distinguished guests, thank you very much for the invitation to be able to speak tonight to the Australia-China Relations Institute. It's a great honour for me to have been invited, and it's a privilege to be here with so many of Australia's China experts. So thank you very much for the invitation. What happens in China is important to Australia and to the broader global community. And that's true in the world of economics as it is in many other areas of influence. So we all have a very strong interest in understanding China. For some years now, China has been Australia's largest export destination, and this is likely to remain so for the foreseeable future. China's share of global GDP is also likely to continue to rise as average living standards in China improve further. Given that China's population is roughly four times that of the United States, the Chinese economy will be roughly twice the size of the US economy when average per capita incomes in China are just half those of the United States, something which should be achievable. It's obviously going to take some time to get to that point, but it's clear that what happens in China matters to us all, and increasingly so. And given this, the Reserve Bank of Australia devotes considerable resources to understanding China and its economy. We have three staff permanently located in Beijing, and they work closely with a team here in Sydney in our Asian Economies Research Unit. We have more staff looking at China than any other single overseas economy. This reflects not just the importance of the Chinese economy to Australia, but also the fact that Australia and China have different political systems, we have different governance arrangements, and we have different financial systems. And understanding these differences is important to understanding the Chinese economy, and the Reserve Bank of Australia is devoting considerable resources to that understanding. In this evening's talk, I'd like to elaborate on two issues. The first is the depth of Australia's economic relationship with China. Too often, this relationship has been viewed largely through the prism of the resources sector. Resource exports are certainly important and they're going to remain important, but this perspective is too narrow. Over time, we're seeing a deepening and a broadening of our economic relationship with China, and I'd like to talk about that this evening. The second issue I'd like to talk about is the Chinese financial system. Among the largest economic risks that Australia faces is something going wrong in China. And perhaps the single biggest risk to the Chinese economy at the moment lies in the financial sector and the big run-up in debt that there's been in China over the past decade. And given the significance of this risk and the RBA's natural interest in finance, we study what's going on here very carefully. Indeed, at the most recent Reserve Bank Board meeting, which we held in Adelaide a few weeks ago, we had a deep dive into the Chinese financial system. We devoted a fair share of the meeting to discussing the risks and issues there, and I'd like to share some of that analysis with you this evening. Before I do that, though, I want to talk about the broadening economic relationship with China. The facts about our trade relationship are well known to you all. Our trade with China has expanded very rapidly over the past decade to the point where China is now Australia's largest trading partner. And as you can see in this chart, China accounts for nearly one-third of our exports and around one-fifth of our imports. This is a marked change to a decade ago. Our trade relationship with China is sometimes summarised as we export resources to China and we import manufactured goods. It's understandable why people have used this shorthand. After all, exports of resources account for two-thirds of our total exports to China, and iron ore and coal alone account for 57% of our total exports. But it would be a mistake to view the trade relationship solely in these terms. That's because our exports to China are much more diverse than this. In many individual categories of exports, we now export more to China than to any other single destination. So what happens in China is now directly relevant to a very broad spectrum of Australian industry. One area where this is very obvious is in the export of services, which you can see here. Over the past decade, Australia's service exports to China have grown at an average annual rate of 15%. That's a very strong outcome. And as a result of that, our service exports to China are now greater than those to the United States and the United Kingdom combined. The growth has been particularly strong in the areas of tourism and education, as you can see in this chart. And there's also been quite strong growth in exports of business services. Last year, there were 1.4 million visitors from China to Australia. That's up from around 400,000 a decade ago. 1.4 million people, that's a lot of people. In 2009, just four passenger airlines flew between China and Australia. Today, there are 15 airlines flying, and last year, there were more than 15,000 direct flights connecting our two countries. And on average, Chinese visitors tend to stay longer in Australia than other visitors, and they tend to spend more money than other visitors. As a result, Chinese visitors now account for around 25% of total visitor expenditure in Australia. That's a considerably larger share than any other country, as you can see in this chart. And this shift is now having a significant effect on our tourism industry, and I expect that that will continue. On the education front, there are currently around 200,000 Chinese students studying in Australia, and there's been very strong growth over recent times. Education exports to China now account for around one-third of Australia's total education exports, up from around a fifth in 2009. Most of the students are studying at the tertiary level, but there's also been an increase in enrolments in Australian schools and vocational education programs. Even so, more than half of all Chinese tertiary enrolments in Australia are in the broad fields of commerce, management, and economics. And for many educational institutions, foreign students, including those from China, have become an important source of fee revenue, with foreign students paying higher fees than domestic students. So this is reshaping education in Australia as well. If I move beyond services, China has become the single largest export market for a whole range of Australia's manufactured food items, as you can see in this chart. Exports of dairy products and alcoholic beverages have grown especially strongly, as have a range of other food and health-related products. And more broadly, there's also been strong growth in exports to China of scientific instruments, pharmaceuticals, and telecommunications products. So that's the trade side. On the financial side too, there has been a broadening and a deepening of the relationship, although it's not as developed on the trade side. Currently, Chinese investment in Australia accounts for only a small share of the total stock of foreign investment in Australia, just at around 3%. In contrast, the United States accounts for the largest share at around 30%. Over time, though, there has been an increase of the amount of Chinese investment in Australia. As you can see on the left-hand side panel of this chart, there was a very large wave of investment in the resources sector in Australia during the mining investment boom. Since that boom, this has tailed off, but there has been a significant investment in other areas, including transport infrastructure and commercial property, although investment in commercial property has slowed recently, partly due to tighter Chinese restrictions in this area, as you can see in the right-hand panel there. The large Chinese banks are now operating in Australia, and they've helped facilitate this investment. And they're also providing banking services to a wide range of businesses in Australia, including Australian businesses. The Reserve Bank of Australia also sees firsthand the strengthening relationship between Australia and China on the financial front. Since 2012, the RBA has had a currency swap arrangement with the People's Bank of China, with the goal of giving market participants confidence that RMB will be available in our domestic market for trade settlement and other payment obligations if that's necessary. The Reserve Bank was also an early investor of our foreign reserves in China, and we now hold 5% of our foreign reserve portfolio in RMB. Furthermore, in 2014, the Bank of China was designated the official RMB clearing bank in Australia, so to better facilitate cross-border settlement in RMB. But there's been a lot happening on the financial side
as well.
The one other dimension of the deepening relationship that I'd like to draw your attention to relates to the people-people connection. Over the past decade, the Chinese-born resident population in Australia has grown at an average annual rate of around 8% a year, and you can see that in this chart. And this builds on the long history of Chinese immigration to Australia, which has contributed very much to the rich multicultural society that we're all fortunate enough to live in today. According to the latest census, people born in mainland China account for 2% of Australia's current population, that's around 510,000 people. And there are more than 1 million people in Australia who identify themselves as having some Chinese ancestry. It's not surprising then that Mandarin is now the second most commonly spoken language in Australian homes, and Cantonese is the fourth most commonly spoken language. If you put all this together, the overall picture is one of a broader and deeper economic relationship with China. Of course, the same could be said for many other countries in our region, and this means that China is important to us not just because of the substantial direct links, but also because of the indirect links through our other regional trading partners. This deepening of our economic relationship with China has greatly benefited Australia. It's created new opportunities for us, and it has significantly boosted our national income. It was also one of the factors that helped our economy through the global financial crisis. This deepening relationship has also benefited China in many ways. This means that both of our countries have a strong interest in managing this important relationship well, and it's our mutual interest to do this. Together, we can be a strong voice for the importance of an open international trading system and for effective regional cooperation. We will, of course, have differences from time to time, but we will surely be better placed to deal with those if we understand one another well. Building strong connections across business, across finance, across politics, academia, and the community more generally are going to be helpful in broadening, in deepening that relationship. So I'm very encouraged that so many of you are here to share in understanding the importance of this relationship. I'd now like to turn to an issue that the RBA has been focused a lot on over recent times, and that's the Chinese financial system. And understanding what's going on here is very important to us. If a major shock were to originate from China over the coming years, its origin is most likely to be in the Chinese financial system. Not surprisingly then, addressing this risk has become a priority for the Chinese authorities, and we have a very strong interest in their interest in this area being successful. I'd like to first provide some background by briefly reviewing the development of the Chinese financial system. I'll then discuss the risks, including those that have been built up in the shadow banking sector, and then finally I'll turn to the recent measures taken by the Chinese authorities to address those risks. If we go back to just 1978, which in the broad sweep of history isn't that long ago, Chinese financial system was very underdeveloped. There was no equity, bond or funding markets, and most of the country's limited banking services were provided by just one bank, the People's Bank of China. It's fair to say that the financial system played only a very rudimentary role in the Chinese economy. But since then, things have changed a lot. In the initial reform years post-1978, some of the functions of the People's Bank of China were carved out into state-owned commercial banks and later into specialised policy banks. It was during these years that the Chinese financial system developed some particular characteristics which we still see today, and two are worth highlighting. The first is that the system is very government-centric. It was configured with the objective of channeling China's high household savings into state-owned enterprises through government-owned banks. And it did this on very favourable terms to the state-owned enterprises. This was part of the Chinese strategy of fast-tracking industrial development and urbanisation. The second characteristic was that there was very heavy financial repression. Extensive capital controls, low deposit rates for savers, extensive restrictions on what banks could do and what they couldn't do, a lack of alternative investment opportunities for savers, and limited access to finance for the fledgling private sector. There was, of course, some progressive liberalisation and financial market innovation over time, but up until fairly recently, the evolution was fairly modest. Things, though, began to change much more noticeably around the time of the global financial crisis, and the result has been an extraordinarily large increase in debt in China. This change was part of the Chinese authorities' efforts to boost internal demand at a time when exports were falling during the financial crisis. As part of this effort, there was a very large lift in spending in infrastructure and property construction. And in other countries, this might have been financed off the government's balance sheet, but in China, a lot of it was financed through the financial system. And achieving this required lessening up of the long-standing constraints on the supply of credit in China. And the end result of this, as you can see here, was a very large increase in the ratio of debt to GDP. That ratio currently stands at around 260%, which is a large number. This increase in the debt ratio has been larger than in any other major economy. And you can see this in this next chart, which shows the increase in the ratio since 2009 for a range of countries and the current level of the debt-to-income ratio. You can see China clearly stands out. The stock of credit outstanding in China, relative to the size of the economy, is now unusually high by the standards of emerging markets, and this ratio is already higher than we see in a number of advanced economies. So what's happened in China is very different to the normal pattern of development. Over this period of rapid credit expansion, there were a series of reforms to modernise the financial system. Interest rate controls have been relaxed, although there's still guidance and the benchmarks still play a significant role. Deposit insurance system was introduced and the regulatory system's been strengthened. Capital markets are also playing a more important role than they were previously. And the large state-owned banks are now listed on stock exchanges in China and in Hong Kong. And it's also easier for private firms to obtain equity finance. And the controls on capital flows have also been relaxed somewhat, although they still exist. I think it's worth recognising that, taken together, these are significant changes. A decade ago, many outside observers were sceptical, very sceptical, that the Chinese authorities would undertake reforms across many of these dimensions. Yet they have made significant progress, to the surprise of many. Despite this progress, though, there is still much to be done before the Chinese financial system looks like the financial systems we see in the advanced economies. One area, though, where the Chinese financial system is moving to a more modern form is in households' access to mortgage finance. Prior to the late 1990s, mortgages were essentially non-existent in China for residential property. But in recent years, households have progressively enjoyed increased access to finance, and this has helped lift the share of consumption in national income. And at the same time as property prices have risen, households have taken on larger mortgages. And as a result, as you can see in this chart, there's been a doubling in the ratio of household debt to GDP. Relative to other emerging market economies, household debt is no longer low in China, although I think, as you can see here, it's still lower than many advanced economies. Putting all this together, the Chinese financial landscape and Chinese balance sheets look very different to those that existed a decade ago. At the same time, though, the financial system does retain elements of the distinguishing characteristics that I spoke about a moment ago. A very heavy focus on state-owned banks providing credit to SOEs and relatively limited banking services for small and medium-sized private businesses. So with that background, I now want to turn to the risks that have built up in that system. The historical cross-country experience is pretty clear here. That experience is that the build-up of the financial risks like those we've seen in China is almost always followed by a marked slowdown in GDP growth or a financial crisis. It's important to point out that those outcomes are not inevitable and that China is able to learn from the experience of other countries, including here in Australia. Even so, it's understandable that the international community has been concerned about developments in the Chinese financial system. One of these concerns is that during the big run-up in debt, a lot of bad loans were made. Assessing the extent of this is made more complicated by the particular nature of the Chinese financial system. On the one hand, the influence of the state and the incentives within financial institutions have almost surely distorted credit allocation and led to some poor lending decisions. For example, rapid credit expansion supported excess capacity developing in some heavy industries, with large loss-making enterprises kept afloat with additional lending, and provincial authorities have also borrowed heavily through opaque off-balance sheet structures so as to meet their growth targets. So it's not unreasonable to suggest that many of these loans would have failed to meet credit standards in other banking systems. So there are reasons to be concerned about future problem loans. On the other hand, though, the involvement of the state can make it easier to work through problems when they arise, and we've seen past examples of this in China. The state has the capacity and the demonstrated willingness to address financial problems when they occur. I think this should provide us with some comfort. However, this support has tended to add to moral hazard in the system. I know the Chinese authorities are concerned about this. So whether the willingness to extend assistance to troubled borrowers and lenders will extend into the future, I think it's difficult to tell. So it's a complicated picture. Another concern is the growth of the so-called shadow banking system. That's credit extended outside the formal banking system. The growth of non-bank financing is evident in this next graph, which again shows the ratio of debt to GDP, but broken down into the type of entities that are providing the credit. I think the picture is pretty clear. Most of the growth in debt has occurred outside the formal banking sector. Non-bank financing now accounts for 45% of total debt. That's up from 25% a decade ago. This growth of shadow banking reflects a few factors. Many entities in China, including private businesses and provincial governments, have had restricted access to credit through the large state-owned banks. And as a result, they have sought finance outside the formal sector, and they've been prepared to pay higher interest rates to get that finance. On the other side of the equation, many investors have sought higher returns on their savings than those available through holding conventional deposits in the formal banking sector. And over time, thousands of smaller banks and other financial institutions have emerged to connect those seeking to borrow outside the formal sector with those seeking the higher returns. And many of these connections that we've seen in China are very innovative, but they're often made through opaque structures, sometimes in off-balance sheet vehicles, and hence the term shadow financing or shadow banking. I think it's useful to provide you with a couple of examples, and you can see these in this next chart. One is the so-called entrusted loans. These loans effectively involve one entity, say one business, lending directly to another entity, say another business, rather than having that loan intermediated across the balance sheet of the bank. Notwithstanding this, the bank would normally act as a trustee to the transaction, and there was often a perceived promise by the bank to absorb any credit losses. So in some respects, these entrusted loans are really like bank loans, but they were structured in a way that sidesteps some of the restrictions on lending and the interest rates that were paid to depositors. And as you can see here, the popularity of these entrusted loans increased very much over the past decade. Another example of shadow financing is the wealth management products. Again, these products were sold in bank branches, often again with an implicit guarantee from the bank. Effectively an investment vehicle offering investors a fixed rate of return higher than bank deposits, with the vehicle investing in a range of assets such as loans and securities. Much of this financing operated in a very similar way to bank loans, but just in another legal form and with a different structure. The products again offered a way of sidestepping some of the regulations, and they helped underpin the rapid growth in debt in China. They offered banks an important new source of income, partly to offset the decline in net interest margins that followed deposit and lending rate liberalisation. The smaller banks have played a particularly important role in the growth of shadow banking. This is evident in this next chart, which shows rapid growth in the claims on non-bank financial institutions, particularly by the smaller banks. There are now over 3,500 smaller institutions, with many of them channeling money to the shadow banking activities, including through trust companies, sometimes in exchange for participation or beneficiary rights. The smaller banks have been more active participants in shadow banking industry because their deposit base is thinner, which prevented them from making loans through the normal channels. So when you putting all that together, it's a complex web of interconnections that has been built up in the Chinese financial system. New institutions have also emerged, and a lot of this has been in the shadows outside the formal regulatory net. It's also worth recalling that we saw a similar process here in Australia in the 1970s. Some of the regulations were eased here and more things became permissible. We too saw new institutions emerge, just as has been the case in China, to sidestep the regulations that did remain. And in our case, this did not end well. And this helps explain why we are watching things so carefully in this area in China. The complex web that has developed in China is characterised by opaque risk transfers, implicit guarantees, and complex connections. To the extent that experience elsewhere in the world is any guide at all, it is difficult to escape the conclusion that this complex web in a highly indebted economy is a risky situation. Dealing with this risk has understandably become a key priority of the Chinese authorities. Reflecting this, at a recent policy meeting convened by President Xi, the leadership called for a gradual reduction in the debt-to-GDP ratio. It was a marked change. Previously, the statements from officials suggested that the objective was to slow the growth in leverage, but now we have the president saying a gradual reduction in the debt-to-GDP ratio would be desirable. The authorities are clearly taking this issue seriously, and they are making progress. The policy response to date has had a number of related elements, and I'll quickly summarise these. One is to subject shadow banking, including asset management activities, to much more stringent oversight. The new rules include stricter leverage caps for investment products and restrictions of investments in certain types of non-standard credit assets. Another element of the response has been stronger guidance to banks regarding their exposure to non-bank financial institutions. And as part of this, the People's Bank of China recently widened the scope of its quarterly macroprudential assessment of the banks to better assess and address shadow banking risks. There have also been efforts to address the significant risks in local government financing, including by increasing the transparency of that financing. As part of this effort, local governments have been participating in a debt swap program where off-balance sheet debt is swapped for local government bonds. And the Ministry of Finance has also tightened off balance sheet financing channels for local governments and their related entities. And at the National Financial Work Conference last year, it was suggested that officials would have lifelong accountability for debt balances. And this was designed to reduce incentives to pursue higher growth by increasing debt. Again, this is a marked change to the situation that we've seen for more than a decade. Finally, the regulatory structure has been strengthened. A particular Financial Stability and Development Committee was established in June last year with very strong political backing. And the committee is responsible for coordinating regulatory reforms and considering financial stability risks. And the banking and insurance regulators have also been merged, partly to address concerns about regulatory arbitrage. These various measures provide a strong signal that the Chinese authorities are serious about addressing the vulnerabilities in the financial sector. Consistent with this, the lower economic growth target for this year of 6.5% does suggest some tolerance for a gradual slowing in growth. I think this is a positive development, given that over recent years there was a concern that the authorities would fail to address the financial risks for fear of damaging the economy in the short run. While it's still early days, the evidence so far is that the various measures are having an effect, and you can see that in this next chart. Growth in credit outstanding or banking system assets has slowed, and it's now running around the same pace as that in nominal GDP. And this is the first time this has been the case for many years. You can see on the right-hand side there's also been a sharp slowing in growth of shadow financing, as reflected in banks' claims on non-bank financial institutions. This tightening on the financial side, together with measures to reduce pollution, has led to some slowing in economic growth in China, although, as you can see, growth remains solid. The slowing is evident in fixed asset investment, although overall activity continues to be supported by very strong conditions in the property sector and by rapid growth in infrastructure investment. In addition, a number of structural developments are providing some offset to the tightening of credit conditions in China. In recent years, the service sector has become the strongest contributor to growth, and consumption has been resilient, and I'd expect that to continue. The government is also promoting industrial upgrading, including through its Made in China 2025 policy, to make China a global leader in numerous high-tech sectors. So there are a lot of moving parts at the moment. It's too early to tell whether the authorities will be successful in managing the transition from a growth model heavily dependent upon the accumulation of debt to one where debt and credit is less central. It's a very significant task they have before them. The experience of other countries does suggest caution, and elsewhere there have been serious accidents along the way. The Chinese authorities can learn from the experience in other countries, including here in Australia, and it is good news that they're now moving in the right direction and they seem serious about addressing these risks. China's challenge, though, is made more complicated by the dual nature of the task to bring down debt levels while also reconfiguring the financial system so that it better meets the needs of the Chinese people. There are pressing needs to make financing more widely available to smaller and medium-sized enterprises, to strengthen the pension system to bolster retirement incomes, to increase transparency in the financial system, and to reduce implicit guarantees associated with local government and SOE borrowing. So there's a lot to be done. As I said, there are a lot of moving pieces, and at the RBA we're devoting considerable resources to understanding this process. And we know from our own experience here in Australia that this journey of financial reform can be a bumpy one. We also know that this journey is well worth undertaking, and at the end it leaves the financial system stronger, it leaves it more efficient, and it leaves it better able to serve the needs of the real economy and our citizens. And I look forward to the day when China will be able to reach the same conclusion about its journey. Finally, it's worth repeating that Australia has a strong interest in this being the outcome. A stable and robust financial system in China is clearly in Australia's interest. So too is a prosperous China as part of a rules-based international system. And as the economic relationship between our two countries broadens and deepens, developments in China are having a material impact on more and more Australian industries, and it's more than just about resources. Now, it's really important, therefore, that we have a thorough understanding of one another, and we all, including everyone in this room, has an important role to play in helping build that understanding. But thank you very much for the opportunity to speak this evening, and I'd be very happy to answer some questions with Bob. Thank you.
Mr. Lowe, we might start with The old talk of soft landing, hard landing. 3 years ago, if you were giving this lecture, the first question would be, is China headed for a soft landing or a hard landing? What's noteworthy for me is that when you talk, say, to people in Hong Kong about Chinese economic prospects now, it doesn't come up. Is that because of the impact of the several important economic financial reforms you've spoken about, or is it that the economy is staying on a growth track because of the Belt and Road Initiative and the increasing expansion of the Chinese middle class?
Yeah, well, it's a very good question. For many years, I've noticed that the people who come to see me and ask about China is a scepticism and pessimism that they could manage the task. And that scepticism and pessimism has been misplaced. The Chinese authorities have managed the task of keeping the economy on a reasonable growth trajectory for quite a few years, and I'm optimistic that they'll continue to do that. As I said in my remarks, it's a significant task they have, but they are addressing the vulnerabilities in the financial system before problems actually arise. Many other countries have had to address problems in the financial system during a crisis. The Chinese are doing it beforehand. And if you think about their underlying growth strategy, it's very clear at the moment that they want to increase the share of consumption in income, and they're taking measures to do that. They have a very clear strategy of moving China up the value-added ladder, and they've got a clear strategy for doing that. It's the Made in China 2025 campaign, and the Belt and Road is about increasing trade and economic linkages through areas of the south and west of China. So they've got clear strategy. They seem to be executing that strategy, and the evidence so far is that it's working. But the financial system issues are still hanging there, and I'm encouraged that they're actually addressing them now.
I wouldn't want this lecture to pass without invoking Donald Trump. Could it be, and this is something I picked up in China a few weeks ago, could it be that by pressing the Chinese to open up their economy more, to set targets and to introduce timetables for bringing down protection, reforming their financial system, opening it up to foreign competition, is actually doing China and the reformers in China a great favour? That the pressure from Trump, including the aggressive trade pressure, is going to be good for the reform task in China?
It's possible. I mean, who knows? It's possible. The Chinese, I think, had a clear strategy of where they wanted to get to, which was a more open China, integrated into not just global trade but global capital markets. The People's Bank of China has long had an ambition of internationalising the RMB and moving to kind of a more modern financial system. So they're moving in that direction, and it may turn out that pressure from the United States has moved, forcing them to move a bit more quickly. I don't know.
How different is the world economy going to look when and because the Chinese economy is twice the size of the US economy? And if I look at that foreign policy white paper that came out late last year, in which we all read very carefully, a graph in that Australian foreign policy white paper suggests that that's going to be the case in 2030.
Yep.
What effect does that have on the way international financial institutions work, on the way policies affecting the world economy are changed, are shifted, if Beijing has got twice the economic clout of Washington?
Yeah, well, the world will look different. I mean, how different, I think it's hard to tell. But when China is the largest economy in the world by a significant margin, it will have extra economic influence. I think that stands to reason. And the global institutions will have to kind of adjust that. The International Monetary Fund, where the US has a veto over certain things, and one imagines that has to change if it's going to remain relevant. I think one area we have focused a lot on is the implications for the financial side, particularly the liberalisation of the Chinese capital account. If Chinese citizens can buy and sell foreign assets just like you and I can, that could have really profound implications for global capital markets, and I think we're still coming to grips with what that is. And and kind of this process of internationalization on the kind of the financial side, that's better if it occurs fairly gradually, particularly when you've got such a big economy. If their citizens can buy and sell foreign assets very easily, that could be quite disruptive for other countries.
So, in what way?
Well, if we kind of see evidence of it kind of at the moment in some countries where the Chinese citizens have wanted to buy property assets, and that's forced up the property prices in some countries, including here. That's been manageable. If we're on a much larger scale, which it conceivably could be, it would be problematic. I think there's kind of at the political level, there's also an issue of the tolerance in many countries for a large-scale foreign investment in property and other assets. So that process has to be managed. So how that works out, I'm not quite sure, but it does need to be managed, because the sheer scale of financial wealth that will exist there and the desire for Chinese national to hold assets in other countries will be strong. And we should find ways of accommodating that, but it needs to be managed, because the flows could be very, very large. And I think that a genuine opening of the Chinese capital account, allowing Chinese citizens to do what you and I can, buy and sell foreign assets whenever we like, that could be really transformation for global capital markets. And it will also put political stresses in countries as well.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Lowe. We've got some questions. Mr. White.
Thank you, Dr. Lowe. James White, ACRI board member and LACEP Investment Management. When we think about the build-up of credit in China, I think there's definitely opacity in the system that it's very hard, particularly as an outsider, to understand. But if we think about the credit build-up in China over the last 10 years since the crisis, from a macro perspective, I think one of the more interesting paradoxes, if you like, is that when we see that credit rise, we would expect inflation. And I think one of the things that's been remarkable about China as an emerging economy has been its low inflation rate. So inflation in China has probably averaged what we've seen in the US over the same period. And clearly, while people worry about Chinese statistics, our own experience is that China has been a deflationary force to an extent, or disinflationary. So to me, it would seem as though, given that low inflation, there is not very much evidence that the cost of capital in China is particularly wrong, given that we haven't seen a build-up in inflation in China other than, say, in asset prices over the course of the last 10 years. How would you respond to that?
Yeah. Well, that the big growth in debt in China has really been used to finance extra productive capacity. How productive it is kind of, there's a question mark over it, but that growth in debt has not been used to finance consumption. It's been used to finance asset accumulation, which has increased the productive base of China, and so I've seen pretty strong productivity growth, which has helped underpin the low rates of inflation. In an alternative world where all that debt had been used to finance consumption, the economy would have overheated and we would have had inflation. So this is kind of an issue to think about going forward as debt slows and more consumers can borrow. Will that balance between building assets and consuming shift, and will that change the inflation dynamics? But I think it's the underlying point is more debt has been used to finance more productive capacity, and that's kept inflation down. That's a good story. You can argue that some of that productive capacity isn't that productive, but the broad story is a lot of it's actually been used to increase the ability of China to produce goods and services.
More questions from media? Please give us your name.
Hi, Lisa Murray from the Australian Financial Review. You just mentioned a couple of times in the speech the importance of China and Australia understanding each other. And I just wondered, from an RBA perspective, do you see any political risk or any economic risk from the political relationship? And is that something you're concerned about?
Well, I can speak about our relationship with the central bank, the People's Bank of China, which is very strong We've had for many years a very positive relationship with them. We talk to them about the issues in their financial system, and they've been very interested in our experience of financial reform. Spoken to them about the operation of the Council of Financial Regulators, how that works in Australia. And so it's a very positive relationship between the central banks. They have been very helpful in us investing our foreign reserves in China as well. So that's a very strong, productive relationship. I'm not going to comment at kind of at the political level, but like in all relationships, there are going to be ups and downs, aren't there? It's happened in our relationship with the US periodically as well. So from where I sit, and I see this kind of broadly with our relationship with the PBOC, there are a few things that can help. Now, if we work on issues where there's a common interest, kind of identify common objectives and we collectively work on them, you work together and you talk, and that actually helps build kind of the relationship. I think having multiple lines of communication helps as well. When our relationship with the US was a bit rocky recently, it was very helpful to have all these other people who we could rely on, and I think that's increasingly the case in China, and many people in this room are part of that network of multiple lines of communication. And I do think it's important that we avoid escalating issues when they arise. There'll be issues coming up periodically, of course. We need mechanisms for de-escalation. And I think we also need ways of need to identify areas where there's a strong common interest, where we can work collaboratively together. So by doing all those things, not just at the political level, but also kind of in the forums that I'm involved in, it kind of helps build the relationship. And there'll be ups and downs, that if we can build the kind of understanding and the connections and multiple lines of communication, we're going to be in a much better position to deal with those. And I think the politicians understand that as well.
Is reinforcing the rules-based world trade system something where Australia and China should be working on a natural rapport? We support the rules, we benefit from the rules, and the WTO and agreements under it are very, very important to Australia, and they seem to be that important to China too.
Yes, increasingly China is a voice for kind of the open rules-based international trading system. They've benefited tremendously from that system, as have we. And I think together we can be a strong voice for that. So if we can identify areas where we have a common interest, and that's clearly one, I think that binds us together and helps us deal with the ups and downs in the relationship. And I see that at the central bank level, when we work together on an issue, it builds trust, it builds the relationship, it builds rapport, and that has benefits in other areas as well. So identifying areas where there's a common interest and working on them, I think it's really important. But we shouldn't forget that the relationship is not just a government-to-government relationship, it's a people-to-people relationship. That's one of the strengths of our relationship with the US, the deep person-to-person connections that people have, and increasingly that's happening in our relationship with China as well, with more than 1 million people living in our great country who have some ancestry in China. There's plenty of potential for very strong, positive, productive people-to-people connections with China, and I think that that's going to stand us in good stead.
Maybe a question here.
You mentioned Jared Hosier.
Name an organisation. Yeah.
I'm freelance. The Belt and Road Initiative, are there opportunities for Australia to sort of engage with that in a meaningful way? And also, you alluded to if citizen capital is freely able to flow out of China, what risks are there to blow back from Australia's public discourse to capital flowing into assets and not necessarily into building industry? Thank you.
On the Belt and Road, I don't know what the particular where the opportunities are for us
Australia has a lot of expertise in infrastructure, so we might be able to kind of leverage that, but I'm not close enough to the details, and there'd be many people in this room who could speak to that much more effectively than I could. In terms of the capital outflow from China, there's a positive side to that because foreign capital is welcome in Australia. We've been importing capital for 200 years to build the asset base of this fantastic country, so Chinese capital can help us do that. I think it becomes more problematic if the capital's coming in and it's not building new assets, it's just buying up the existing assets and forcing their price up. That's not just an issue with Chinese capital, it's an issue with any foreign capital coming into Australia. So we've got to manage that, and the best foreign capital is the one that comes in and creates new assets for this country, and some Chinese capital is doing that, and that's a positive thing. As I said before, the medium-term issue is just the scale and volatility of those flows. How are we going to manage them? How are the Chinese going to manage them, and how are we going to manage them?
Question here.
Yeah, my name is Yun Feng. I'm from China Construction Bank Senior Branch. So the questions are actually on behalf of the branch and also our general manager, Mr. Jin. I actually have two parts of questions. The first part is Governor Low, on your first half of the speech, you actually said how important the economic relationship is between China and Australia. I'm not sure if you recently noticed two points on the trade. One is the currency rate between Chinese yuan and Australian dollar. It's been so many years as dropping below 5 CNY to 1 Australian dollar, which is actually helping the export business from Australia to China, and also the current talks between the United States government and the Chinese government on the easing the trade wars between the two countries. And the Chinese government actually agreed to cut the deficit between the two current accounts between China and the United States. So I'm not sure if you actually consider that as a potential threat to the potential for the future Australian to China economic relationship, because considering the common products provided by the United States and also the Australia, particularly in the resources and also in the agriculture products, if the Chinese government agrees to buy more from the United States, that means they have to cut down some of the demand to Australia. Even with the helping FX rate, helping the Australian economy. But I'm not sure if you actually consider that as a potential threat. So if, as a strategy, would you be probably in the future considering using CNY or Australian dollar as a settlement currency rather than the US dollar currency in some of the products Australia provide to China? That's my first question. My second question is...
Let's deal with that.
Okay. Well, just on the issue of whether some special agreement between the United States and China to kind of open up trade is a threat to us, I don't see that at all. Because I see this really just as another step in movement towards a more open China. It'll be more open maybe in the first instance with the United States, but if it's a step along that journey, I think that's going to be positive for Australia. And if there's a step towards stronger protection of intellectual property in China, that's going to be a positive development for Australia as well. So I don't see an agreement that between the United States and China is deleterious to Australia's interests at all. In the long term, it should be a positive one. In terms of the use of the US dollar versus RMB, it's not a direct issue for the Reserve Bank of Australia. We invest a small share of our foreign reserves in China, and I think it's appropriate that we do that, but the share is small, and I don't see us replacing US dollar reserves on a large scale with RMB reserves for some time, because the market is still not as liquid and not as deep, and it's not as easy to transact as it is when we're buying and selling US Treasury securities, and we hold foreign reserves really for liquidity and market ease of access. That things are improving in China, but it's going to take some way before it gets to the same situation that the US bond markets are in. And the other thing we've been doing is trying to bring to Australian exporter and importer's attention that they can invoice in RMB. And I've spoken in a number of forums to encourage that. And I have to say, many businesses still say, well, they're not really keen to do it because the hedging markets haven't developed enough, or if the hedging markets are there, the costs are too expensive. So it can be still cheaper to go from RMB into Australian dollars through the US dollar. This is what some corporates tell us. And then the hedging markets aren't there to do a direct hedge AUD-RMB. So over time that will change, and I think as the Chinese authorities are prepared to allow the exchange rate to move up and down, the markets will develop, and then more people, the costs will come down and people will be prepared to trade. We saw this kind of in Australia in the early years when we floated the currency and it wasn't moving very much. People weren't used to hedging. The markets weren't deep, the cost was high, and so people wouldn't hedge. And as gradually the process developed, the markets develop and people feel comfortable, and I think this will happen with the RMB, but it's going to take time.
Mm.
And then more and more Australian corporates dealing with China will be happy to invoice in RMB. They'll find it the most effective way of doing it, and they'll find the cost of hedging the currency risk to be acceptable.
Governor James Glynn from the Wall Street Journal. Your predecessor once said to me that what kept him awake at night was the lack of transparency on China. Is that changing? Are the Chinese becoming more transparent in their markets and in how they present data and how they just present themselves to the world? Is that becoming something that's easier to understand? And just as a quickly second question, in the last RBA minutes, there was a suggestion that the Reserve Bank wants to promote a period of stability and confidence in the economy. I'm just interested if you could expand on that, because I thought we were confident and I thought we were stable. I'm just wondering if you could just give me a few words on that, please.
on greater transparency in China, I think there is a move in that direction. You're seeing gradually in the financial sector an improvement in the transparency. And I have to say, in the meetings that I go to in Basel with the governors of the central banks, the Chinese governor is very clear about their agenda. I think he's very, very open, and I see this more and more with Chinese officials. They're very open when they're talking about the issues in the financial sector. It's a positive thing. There's more work to be done, but we're moving in the right direction. And I see there's a lot of things in China. Things are moving in the right direction, and we can be impatient. In the 40 years since 1978, when you step back and think the amount of change that's gone there, it's truly tremendous. And I think they're kind of on a process that's working for them, and often the rest of the world is impatient, and understandably so, but whatever they're moving in the right direction, I think it's a positive thing. In terms of our minutes, we mentioned we're interested in promoting both stability and confidence. Well, we always are. what we're trying to do at the moment, well, by keeping interest rates low and stable, I hope that engenders confidence in the community and stability in the asset markets and borrowing behaviour. So it's nothing. It wasn't meant to signal anything out of the ordinary. It was really stating what I see as kind of the obvious. We're promoting stability and confidence in the Australian economy, and we're setting about a policy to try and do that. So there's nothing more to it or less to it than that.
Fine. A last question. Here, sir.
Yes, Andrew Stabak, Asia-Pacific Banking and Finance Magazine and Events. I have the opportunity in my role as publisher of that business to ask the CEOs of the Australian banks their posture and strategy on a range of fronts. And when I used to ask them about their position on China and their engagement with China and want to be more engaged with China, you know, 10 years ago they were very assertive.
Yep.
One of the banks having a super regional strategy and the others fairly positive towards their investment and so on. Now, that posture has changed somewhat, I've noticed, over the last few years, to the point where they're now all saying, look, we will support our customers going into China and doing business with China, but really it's limited to that. Is there a message and I'm sure you get to talk to the Australian banking sector on a regular basis, but is there an overall message from the Reserve Bank about their general posture and positioning towards their engagement in China today that the rest of the Australian public and possibly China should be aware of that you'd like to send to our Australian banking sector about their view and position into China going forward?
Well, it's entirely up to them. We're not in the business of kind of directing the banks to invest in one particular part of the world or another. The withdrawal from China, to the extent that that's taking place, it's not China, it's kind of Asia generally. I think the Australian banks are finding it hard to earn the type of return on equity that they've been able to earn in this market in Asia. And there are a whole bunch of reasons we could go into why that's the case. And so they've found that hasn't been an attractive place to invest. But we're not in the business of telling them what to do. I think it's disappointing they haven't been able to make a go of it, because we do have some advantages in the financial sector that we could leverage in China and Asia, but the banks have had trouble doing that and earning the required returns on equity. And perhaps their horizons aren't as long as they might otherwise be, but that's what it is.